Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. This is an Age of Sigmar episode. I am joined today by Ricky Addington.
We finally convinced him to do one more.
So Ricky is actually on assignment. He's not at home. You are away. You are recording remote under special conditions. And so thanks for you for doing it, but thanks to everyone for bearing with us while we do it.
Yeah, like, so if it sounds like I'm in a tin can or you hear any, basically any noise, just accept the fact that I am talking to you from the barracks basement of lovely Fort Pickett, Virginia.
Well, we will make sure and do our best. I want to talk about the core rules for Age of Sigmar 2.0.
I am very excited about this.
There's some things here. One, the core rules are no longer just four pages. I know that's been a big topic of discussion. There are now 9 pages of core rules. That's double plus one from the old
it's the double the edition. Fun.
it's
there was a lot from the you know, the leaks and release information and stuff like that. I'm really happy with all the changes that I've seen so far have been very exciting, and I can't wait to see how they actually kind of change up the meta for the game in the coming year. It's going to be great.
This is pretty interesting. You know, some of the stuff. Now, I'm not an Age of Sigmar expert. I enjoy playing. I have a couple of armies, but I'm not what I would consider like a tactical genius or know all the nuances of what became, you know, I'm going to use it in quotation, the meta from the previous version of Age of Sigmar. So if I'm reading some of this and it's, you'll need to tell me if it's the way it was, but I'm pretty excited about some of the clarifications that have been made here. And it starts right out with units. Units have to maintain a 1-inch coherency. And
yeah, that's the same. Yep.
There are some specific rules for units that get split up. If something happens during the game that would cause them to be split up to where they cannot maintain that 1-inch coherency or find themselves into smaller groups of miniatures.
Okay. How did they reword that there?
Well, I'll just tell you, it says check out the rules for splitting up on the next page, or actually it's 2 pages away, and the smaller units go away.
Whoa. Okay. So that nuclear option. Okay, cool.
We'll read that right. I'm going to read it right now. Unit must be set up and finish any sort of move as a single group. All models within 1-inch horizontally and 6-inch vertically of at least one other model from their unit. That's how they stay in coherency. Okay. If the unit is split up at the end of a turn, models must be removed from the unit until only a single group of models remains in play. See split units on page 230. So it's technically 4 pages away from that page.
Wow. Pardon my language, but diggity dang. But that's good. That's good. Like, so it's one of those things that was really gray before, and we weren't real sure. I think at one point they said as long as they can, and a lot of tournaments were just ruling it different ways, but it was, you know, now it was, you know, just if they could move and get within coherency and stuff. But what that will cause and will force players to do is that you know, that they'll have to be careful on how they remove models, and model placement will matter more. So I think that's going to be a really good change. It was a good clarification on the rules, and I think it'll be an interesting change. So
let me jump.
Yeah, I'm totally happy with that.
I'll probably jump from section to section as it may be relevant, but the split unit text is, at the end of each turn, you must remove models from any of the units in your army that are split up into 2 or more groups until only one group of models from the unit remains in play. The models you remove count as having been slain.
And that was at the end of each turn?
Yes, each turn.
So, yep. Player turn?
I would imagine that's player turn because it goes through the phases. Actually, I guess not.
For any units.
Yeah, because this is going through the phase, you know, combat phase, battle shock phase, and it says split units. So I would imagine that's any turn.
And here's the reason that rule is terrifying, is because there are units in, you know, Age of Sigmar that, like, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, I'm thinking of the Lord Celestine on Stardrake, who is allowed to pick models within so many inches of him that he wants to eat, right? So if you have your unit strung out, he could run right into the middle of it, eat 3 models, and then they're out of coherency.
Wow.
and then they're that half that unit's dead.
Well,
First off,
there
I think
you
we may have just broke the game, but
we'll
I'm
get
putting
into
that
some.
Guy back in my list.
Yeah, we'll get into some War Scrolls and stuff. But I think everything's going to remain intact. There are with this release, we'll also see the General's Handbook 2018, and some persistent spells. The game is going to change a fair amount. Let's just say that
it's just
does.
The spells are. I'm more excited about persistent spells and magic than I think any other factor in the game. It's going
to
be really cool.
Oh, it's cool stuff. We're going to try to confine this conversation just to the core rules. Something that stuck out to me, now the hero phase has changed a bit.
Yeah, you mean a lot.
Well, okay. Well, if you have any heroes in your army, you can use command abilities. Some command abilities are available to all armies, like the three on the right, and that's what it shows. And it's at the double, forward to victory, and inspiring presence. While others are specific to certain models and appear on the war scroll, some of these command abilities can only be used if that model is your general. When this is the case, it would be noted in the rules for the command ability. In order to use any command ability, you must spend one command point. You start the battle with one command point for each War Scroll battalion you have in your army. In addition, you receive one command point at the start of each of your hero phases. You can use the same command ability several times in the same phase as long as you have enough command points to do so. Any command points you do not use can be used in a future turn. A command ability will usually specify when it is used. If it does not, it is used in your hero phase.
Maybe the most exciting and important change to Age of Sigmar right there. The fact that you are going to be able to save command points if you don't use them and carry over and pop off three or four command abilities at that pivotal moment is going to change the way the game is played. It reminds me more of how stratagems work in 40K with the ability to kind of save those command points in 40K for when you really need to pull off that one stratagem and make something big happen. You're going to be able to do that now in Age of Sigmar. And just from my standpoint, from a Stormcast Eternals player, there's a lot of times where my command abilities aren't useful, they're just not necessary that turn. So, if I don't change anything about my army, there will be a turn or two where I may not even have to use anything.
Well, let me go over what these base command abilities are. And I think you're going to get a little excited. But you're right. You still may not need them all, but there's a reason I think. Okay, here's at the double. You can use the command ability after you make a run roll for a friendly unit that is within 6 inches of a friendly hero or 12 of a friendly hero if that's your general. If you do so, the run roll is treated as a six. I like that because it's after you roll. You can say, I'm just going to burn the command and make it what I want.
Yeah, that's great.
Forward to victory. You can use this command ability after you make a charge roll for a friendly unit that is within 6 inches of a hero, 12 if it's your general. If you do so, re-roll the charge roll.
Finally.
I think that's strong. And in an inspiring presence, you can use this command ability at the start of the battle shock phase. If you do so, pick a friendly unit that is within 6 or 12 if it's the general. The unit does not have to take battle shock test in that phase. So that you don't get to roll for and then choose later. You have to just say,
right,
we're going to use it.
Now, Inspiring Presence is kind of an interesting one to me because it simultaneously got way worse and way better at the same time because it got way worse in that it's only good for that phase. All right. So that kind of sucks compared to the old one, right? But it got way better in that you don't have to pop it off until the battle shock phase. You don't even have to use it. Like, whereas before, at the beginning of your turn, you did Inspiring Presence. And yes, it covered your guys for the entirety up until your next turn. So that was great. Those guys were inspired. They're not going anywhere. But that was your command ability. If you had two command abilities on your general, you had to pick, am I going to use Inspiring Presence or am I going to use whatever other ability you had? Well, now I can pop off the ability I want to use, and if my guys get in trouble in a certain phase, I can use Inspiring Presence. So Inspiring Presence isn't that mandatory, have to do it every turn. Mm-hmm. So you can save that command point if you don't need it until you do need them. So it got a lot more flexible. It could potentially be costlier if your opponent is hitting you in, you know, each phase and just really wrecking you. But I hate to say it, but that unit's probably going away anyway if you're getting forced that many battle shock tests,
it's
right?
It's an aggressive game still, I'll tell you that. It then gets into the movement phase, and it clarifies. There's a section here on what a normal move is. Like, basically everything that's not some kind of specific move is a normal move. And I know that probably just sounds kind of silly to say. But, you know, as we get things stacked on and battle tomes and more rules come out, I think it's going to be good to have this baseline for what a normal move is. It also covers enemy units and retreats. When you make a normal move for a model, no part of the move can be within 3 inches of an enemy unit. Units starting a normal move within 3 inches of an enemy unit can either remain stationary or retreat. If a unit retreats, it can move within 3 inches of an enemy, but must end the move more than 3 inches from all enemy units. Models in a unit that retreats can't shoot or charge later in the turn.
You said, but they can end. They cannot end their move.
They can while they're moving. They can come within 3 inches of an enemy.
Oh, but they can't end the move. Okay, so they do have to get out. Now, is there any change to running during a retreat? Because 40K, you can't do that. Sigmar, you're allowed to run out of the retreat. There was no verbiage against it. Was there?
It just says models in a unit that retreats can't shoot or charge later in the turn. Running, it says when you pick a unit to make a normal move, you can declare it will run. Make a run roll for the unit by rolling a dice. Add the results to the run roll to the move characteristic for all models in the unit for that movement phase. The unit can then move up to that distance in inches. Models in a unit that runs can't shoot or charge.
Cool. So there's still, because me, if I'm retreating, I'm going to run as far as I can. That's just me. I'm a coward like that.
Right. There's no, you can't advance if you fall back or whatever. This is right. Enemy units and retreating. The flying is, I think, as we might expect, but it's important to note that there is no exclusion. Like, there's no, like we have in 40K, a flying model can retreat, but there's nothing in here saying it can shoot still.
Effectively no change. It's just a clarification, just better verbiage. And it seems like, on the whole, that's a lot of what we're seeing with these rules, is not groundbreaking or fundamental changes to the game, just clarifications on the core mechanics so far.
Yeah, and the shooting phase, in your shooting phase, you can shoot models armed with missile weapons. I mean, duh, right? Right. Each model in the unit attacks with all of the missile weapons it's armed with. And then it's a C attacking. And then it goes on to tell you, remember, the models that have run or retreated cannot shoot in the same turn. There's no unless you fly or unless you do this or whatever. It's just they can't do it.
Right. But there is one huge change. There's a huge change to shooting.
Enemy units can shoot. A unit can shoot when it is within 3 inches of the enemy. But if it does so, it can only target enemy units that are within 3 inches of it with its shooting attacks. A unit can shoot at an enemy of the unit that is within 3 inches of another friendly unit without penalty.
And that may be, some people may consider that just a wee bit of a big change to the game.
Well, when I'm firing with my Colonel Hunters, that's a big change.
Yeah.
Because they are really good at tanking and not moving very far and getting charged and shooting things 30 inches away. No more. Can't do that anymore.
Yeah. Games Workshop was even talking about on Warhammer Community is how much more important that is going to make fast moving units to get over there and lock down those archers and protect the units you don't want shut off the table.
I like that. Look out, sir. You must subtract one from hit rolls made for missile weapons if the target of the attack is an enemy hero within 3 inches of an enemy unit that has three or more models. Not a big fat unit or whatever. It has three or more models.
I just want to say right here to Games Workshop, thank you from the bottom of my heart, because I don't know how many times I have sat there and watched my Lord Celestine get shot off the table.
Well, there's another rule here. So, look out, sir. Rule does not apply if the target hero is a monster.
And he is not.
I just wanted it before we got too far.
No. It's a great rule, and it just kind of makes sense, you know, that he would, you know, be a little more protected. But it's going to make those armies with maybe squishier heroes and generals. Like I'm thinking like Stormcast Eternals. They're normal. You know, their characters on foot. They do have good saves, but they are kind of susceptible to being sniped out easily. The Free Guild, there's just tons of characters out there that can be shot off the table very easily. Whereas some armies, all of their good heroes are big giant monsters who can take a hit. You know, so I think it's gonna let us be a little more courageous with what models we put in our lists and get to kind of be a little more aggressive with those heroes instead of trying to hide them in the back out of line of sight of people. So just I'm really excited for that.
The store, you know, or the tournament has some good line of sight blocking. You might
get a
little bit of insurance there.
I need something 3 inches wide by 3 inches tall, and my guy's good, and now I can actually move him around.
The charge phase, at any of your units within 12 inches of the enemy in your charge phase can attempt to make a charge move. Pick an eligible unit and make a charge roll for it by rolling 2d6. Each model in the unit can move a number of inches equal to the charge roll. You cannot make a charge move if you had run or retreated. We knew that. With a unit that is within 3 inches of an enemy unit. So if you're already within 3 inches, you can't do another charge.
Right. Yeah.
The first model you move from a unit making a charge move must finish the move within half an inch of an enemy model. You do not have to pick the target for the charge before making the charge roll. You just say they're going to charge, roll the dice.
Yeah, it sounds like no change there. So that's pretty good. Now, we are going to see a big change in the pile-in, though.
Okay, piling in. So then you go through the combat phase, and you nominate. When it's your turn, you must either pick an eligible unit to fight with or pass. A unit is eligible to fight if it's within 3 inches of an enemy unit or if it has made a charge move in the same turn. No unit can fight more than once. If you pick a unit to fight, it first piles in, and then the models in the unit must attack. If you pass or do nothing, and the option to fight or pass goes back to your opponent. If both players pass in succession, the combat phase ends. A unit can make a pile-in move if it's within 3 inches of an enemy or has made a charge move in the same phase or the same turn. If this is the case, you can move each model in the unit up to 3 inches. Each model must finish its pile-in move at least as close to the nearest enemy model as it was at the start of the move.
That right there is really important because it's the same as in 40K. You know, Sigmar used to be the same as 40K. You know, once you're base to base, you can't move, right? Because you can't get closer than base to base. So now it says at least as close.
And at least as close, right?
Exactly. So if you're in base to base, you can still kind of use that 3 inches to pivot around.
Yeah, scoot around to the back of that model or whatever.
And, because we've all done it. In 40K and Sigmar, we've gotten into a combat and we've gotten bogged down and couldn't get our guys up because either we got into base contact or our opponent piled in and got into base. So now it's going to allow you to kind of finagle your models around a little more freely, and it's going to be great for that, and it's also going to be great for just cutting down that I had you in base. Oh, did you? Because it's not in base. You know, it's like you get those arguments. You see them all the time. I've seen them at my own tournaments. You know, when people, you know, when something important is happening, all of a sudden, you know, it's people see things differently. Is it base? Is it not? And now it doesn't matter. As long as you end up in base, it doesn't matter if you were in base or not. So I think that's a great rule. It's going to help out on both sides, and I think it's going to kind of alleviate a little bit of was it or wasn't it tension in games.
That sounds good. Fighting, it now clarifies, you have to basically fight with all of the types of things you can fight with. So if you're in melee, you have to fight with all your melee weapons. If you choose to shoot, you have to shoot with all your shooting weapons.
Right. It's kind of weird, though, because, yeah, you can't hold back, but it says you can pass, right?
In the combat phase, the players take it in turn to pick units to fight with, starting with the player whose turn it is taking place. When it is your turn, you must either pick an eligible unit to fight with or pass. Note that you cannot pass if there's an eligible unit from your army
that can
fight.
Okay, that's the verbiage that I wanted to hear there, because
You have to fight.
because yeah, and because that I mean I've run into that. There's I mean I don't know if it happens to everybody, but at Adepticon this past year, I was playing against a Legions of Nagash army, and every time I was killing skeletons, they were just coming back from the dead and getting closer to my objectives. So
Chose not to
I
kill
stopped
him.
attacking them. Yeah, and I stopped attacking them, and then my guys had a two-up save, rerolling ones. So he just said, "All right, I'm not going to swing at your guys. You're not going to swing at me. Let's just skip all of this and go on." And so we just skipped probably I would say 30, we probably 100 models just didn't even attack during the game because it didn't really matter. So that's an interesting change. It's a good change for undead, I think, for certain tactics that they employ. I think it's good that
Interesting.
they have to be attacked.
In the attacking rules here, it basically the kind of the overarching theme here is that if you're splitting things up or attacking with more than one thing, that you resolve all of one before going on to the next one. Some and then it goes on to say after that bit of stuff that some models are armed with two identical weapons, two daggers, for instance, or whatever. When attacking with these weapons, do not double the number of attacks that the weapons make. Either the attack's characteristic for the weapon will already take an extra weapon into account, or the model will get an ability on its war scroll that represents the effect of an additional weapon.
Right, that's a good clarification. I mean, most people know that. Most war scrolls are very clear about that, but it's still good to have that clarified there in the rule book because I know a lot of newer players are wondering that themselves.
It goes on to the making attacks is hit roll. This is the order of operation: hit roll, wound roll, save roll, then determine the damage. And the allocating wounds is pretty much the same. Once all of a unit's attacks have been resolved, add up the damage that was inflicted. The player commanding the target unit must then allocate a number of wounds to the target unit equal to the damage that was inflicted. Wounds are allocated one at a time to a model in the target unit. You can allocate the wounds inflicted on your units as you see fit. The models do not have to be within range or visible to the attacking unit. However, if you allocate a wound to a model, you must keep on allocating wounds to that model until it is slain. A unit can never have more than one wounded model.
All right, so sounds pretty much the same as it was before. Nothing really stands out there, so no change there, I think.
Yeah, don't think so. Goes on to wizards then. Of course, some units have the wizard keyword. And they all,
What? No.
right? There are a bunch of lords of spells. They're also in this book. You can cast the spell. You roll 2d6. The total is equal or greater than this casting value. The spell is successfully cast. Wizards within 30 inches can attempt to unbind the spell.
Big
Only,
change
yeah,
there.
only one attempt can be made to unbind the spell.
Big change with that 30-inch range. That's great for all the other wizards. It kind of changes, I guess, how great the benefit for Seraphon is, because Seraphon, under the 2017 General's Handbook, their big thing is they can unbind from anywhere on the table. So now that they've increased the utility of other wizards' ability to unbind, I think that kind of hurts Seraphon. It doesn't hurt them, but it makes it less
Little
attractive to be
special
a Seraphon wizard.
thing, right? Yeah, I
Right,
get
yeah.
you.
So, but that could change. That could change with the 2018 General's Handbook. I hope it doesn't change too much because I think Seraphon has some really great and really fun abilities. So, hopefully we'll get into that at some point too.
Arcane Bolt. So the generic spells, Arcane Bolt, has a casting value of 5. With you pick a unit within 18 inches, they suffer one mortal wound. If you cast it on 10 or more, it's D3 mortal wounds.
Yeah, big change there, going down to one mortal wound unless you really knock that roll out of the park.
The
So
Mystic Shield, casting value of 6. You pick a friendly unit within 18 inches. Reroll save rolls of 1 for that unit until your next hero phase.
huge change, and I think it's a I think I would consider it a nerf. I really do think I would consider that a bit of a nerf, mainly because I play Stormcast, and when I ally in a wizard, I already have my shield that rerolls once. So it that kind of hurts. And the reason I keep going back to Seraphon is my nephew plays Seraphon. One of my best friends plays Seraphon, so I see Seraphon a lot. They already have they have an ability in their army that they can reroll all failed save rolls. So that plus one that they used to get from Mystic Shield was huge, because it went from a 5-up save to a 4-up save, rerolling all failed saves. It gave them almost like a 75% chance to save a wound. And now that reroll ones, it's kind of, well, it's useless to them if they have that other ability in place. So I'm really interested to see where Mystic Shield goes and see how it plays out in competitive play, especially.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is, I think, a big change, and that's going to have something that people relied on not be quite as reliable, I don't think.
Yeah.
There's a section here called Triumphs, and this is if your army won a major victory in its previous battle, roll a dice when you pick your general and look up the result on the table below. it's three things that you can give your general an extra benefit. Kind of interesting. I'm you know, I don't think that'll make its way into the match play stuff, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, they were there. They were there before. You know, they've always been there. You know, and we are a competitive podcast. You know, that's kind of the slant we usually go with everything. So usually when we talk about things, it's more of a competitive type thing. So yeah, when we go to tournaments and stuff, we don't really see those triumphs being used so much. However, in narrative play campaigns and stuff like that, like we run the Firestorm campaign at the store, and we have a lot of stuff going on, and the triumphs are really fun there, and it makes you know, it makes each victory just a little bit sweeter when you get to, you know, rock that triumph on somebody.
The terrain rules are different. For instance, I know the mystical terrain used to kind of be a big dagger to folks.
Yeah.
Mystical is now roll a dice each time you allocate a wound or mortar wound to a model within 1 inch of any mystical terrain feature. On a 6+, that wound or mortar wound isn't negated.
Okay. Wait a second. That's my shipwreck from Idoneth Deepkin. Now they're just giving it the mystical terrain? Psh, okay, whatever.
Well, there are new rules for all that those things.
Yeah.
So we'll
that's
see.
That's going to be fun.
But they actually... If I saw right, they're putting out dice that have these symbols on them, so it's going to be incredibly easy to generate these effects for terrain.
It's going to be good for two reasons. One, it makes it easier for people to even remember that Mystic that the terrain is a thing, because I don't know how many games I've played and we forget to roll for terrain. The other thing is, just as many times as we've forgotten to roll for terrain, I've seen just as many ways that people have marked that terrain. I've seen tokens. I've seen custom dice. At Adepticon, a guy and I sat down and wrote it out on pieces of paper because neither of us remembered to bring the terrain. You know, so all these things out there. And I guarantee I will sell a set of those dice to every Age of Sigmar player in my store.
Go ahead and put me down for one.
Yeah, it is. There's no way that isn't going to sell. And as long as they're not clear, like those items.
No, they're not. Dice. They look pretty sharp. I mean, I definitely implore you to check them out if you have not already. Then we get in the further terrain. There's garrisons, which is like fortifications. Mm-hmm. Some terrain is going to have the garrison rule. Enemy unit or not enemy unit, units can be deployed inside.
Oh, cool. Now, is this? That's not like one on the chart that you or like on the list to roll for that.
No,
terrain,
no, no.
Right?
That's its own thing. Some terrain features can be garrisoned by units.
Okay, great. So if it has that rule, then
it will be noted on the war scroll for the terrain feature.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's not the random terrain effects. These are.
I was about to say, like, you know, rolling a hill, and all of a sudden, guys are garrisoned inside the.
And they're in. It's a hobbit hole. It's actually a hobbit hole.
Yeah. They're dwarves. It's cool. It's okay. That's fine.
I mean, that's pretty much the core rules, man.
Man, we made it through the whole rule book in like 10 minutes. That's
well,
pretty
they're,
good.
They're, it goes on to describe allegiance abilities, you know, what a war scroll battalion is,
right.
And then the actual how to read a war scroll and battle plan missions kind of thing. But
it's kind of a, yeah. I'm sorry, it was it's amazing to me how few rules changed, yet how important all those changes are, and how insane the meta could be affected, how people's lists and the way the game is going to be played can potentially just be, you know, it's going to be shaken up substantially, and it's going to be a really fun couple of months because everybody's going to be building new lists and everybody's going to be painting new models, and this is exactly what Age of Sigmar needed right now. Because, you know, if I'm honest, my Age of Sigmar community has dwindled a little since 8th edition of 40K came out, because, you know, it kind of got all the excitement and everybody loved those new rules, and so Sigmar kind of died down a little. So I'm really excited because we are definitely going to see a resurgence and people getting excited to come back and try their armies out again with this new rule set. So
let's talk a little bit about the endless spells, if you
please
don't mind.
Yes. No.
Well, that's another big change. You know, these the endless spells in the I think it's the Malign Sorcery supplement. They're going to, each one of the spells is going to have its own data slate, its own war scroll.
And these are all going to be in a single box set, right?
Yeah, and it's awesome. By the way, it is a giant box set with tons of cool stuff in it.
Yeah, I thought when they first started announcing it, I just thought it was going to be like the Bellwind Vortex. You know, like you buy the model of the spell you want, but the fact that you're just going to buy one box and it's going to have everything, the spells, the cards, everything you need, all in that one thing. I'm super excited about that. It kind of reminds me of the old Dark Millennium. You remember from 40K, the old Dark Millennium?
No, let me tell you how satisfying these box sets are. The Age of Sigmar 2nd Edition starter set, if you will, it's a heavy, giant box. I mean, it's just very satisfying to hold and open. it is awesome. The book is there. All those great figures are there. It's very satisfying. And the Malign Sorcery box is the exact same way. You feel solid. It feels like it's got a ton of stuff in it. Now, we're not going to go all over all the War Scrolls right now for the endless spells, but I thought we'd talk about just how they work.
Right. Yeah. And just to speak on those boxes real quick, like, have you noticed how, like, Games Workshop lately, it's like when you buy, you know, not for everything, not like when I go buy like a box of Cadians or something, but when you drop some money on a model or a new book or something, and especially these box sets, it's you're getting that, like, what they're calling the unboxing experience now. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're opening it up, and it's the new Dark Imperium when it come out, you know, and it everything was just set in there real nice, and you had this. When you open it, there's the book, and there's just all this iconography and everything over it. And it's like you're jumping into this world when you open it up. I'm very excited about that. Like, I know that's costing them a little money to put that extra effort into that presentation, but
it's worth
it. Mean something to me. Yeah, it makes it a little more exciting.
It does, and that I get all those feels when I'm opening these boxes.
Yeah, I'm not afraid to admit it. Now quit stalling and talk to me about these spells.
So the endless spells, they have models. So these are things that you build, you paint, and you summon on the battlefield. So I shouldn't say summon, because the summoning rules are pretty awesome. This is a spoiler for when we talk about those. But you cast them onto the battlefield. And some are immobile. Some are what they call predatory endless spells.
That's exciting.
And you have to have the model to cast the spell. And the example they give in the core book here is that if you only have two Bellwind Vortexes in your collection, you can't summon a third. I said summon again. You can't cast a third.
Right, and that was a question I was going to ask, but since we're on that, so if I cast, I can't think of the names of it, but you know, like that floating skull thing or that floating fireball skull.
Yeah.
So if I cast that, like, now even in match play, I can't cast the spell more than once, but if I cast that endless spell, you know, turn one, and I have a model, I can cast it again on turn two and have two of those?
That's all obviously going to be determined in match play. But I believe that to be the case based on what the wording is here.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see.
Yeah. However, most of them are immobile, but some of them can move across the battlefield in search of living prey. Predatory endless spells are moved at the start of each battle round after the players determine who will have the first turn, but before the first turn begins. The players alternate picking a predatory endless spell to move, starting with the player who has the second turn. A player must pick a predatory endless spell to move if any are available, but only predatory endless spells that have not been moved can be chosen. Once all predatory endless spells have been moved, start the first turn of the battle round. The distance a predatory endless spell can move will be noted on its war scroll. Some of them can fly, also will be noted. Unlike other models, a predatory endless spell can cross the edge of the battlefield when it is moved. However, if it does so, the spell is immediately dispelled. See, removing endless spells. The effects and abilities of the predatory spell are resolved by the player who moved that model for that battle round. An endless spell remains in play until it is removed from the battlefield. An endless spell can only be removed from play if a wizard dispels the endless spells described below. The endless spell crosses the edge of the battlefield when it's moved. A method described on the model's war scroll is used to remove the spell from play.
How is that not awesome? Like, in, so there's so many things about that that we could. Well, I mean, we could just sit here and think about how it would change the game and how it would affect the game. Like, there's so many factors that go into that. And let's just focus on one thing first off, and that's like, I'm going to cast a spell and like try to make this like flaming skull come and eat you, right? And then your wizard is going to have to decide, okay, do I cast the spell I want to cast, or do I unbind this and dispel it off the battlefield? Like, first off, that is cinematic as all get out. It's exciting. It's, you know, it's there's strategy to it, and then so there's that, okay, but then there's also going to be the whole thing of the person who goes second gets to move that spell first, right?
Yeah, gets to move the first spell, yeah.
So all of a sudden, it's, you know,
yeah, do I
win the roll-off? Yeah, I win the roll-off to go next turn, right? Do I want to go first? Because if I go first and that spell is right in my face, my opponent is going to shove that spell down my throat.
Run that thing over me, yeah.
Exactly. Or do I take it, go second, and then try to get that thing turned around and onto him? It's going to create just an extra layer of strategy that as a Stormcast player who doesn't have a whole lot of wizards, oh wait, guess what's getting ready to happen? But
get some wizards. have one of your Stormcast wizards on the Bellwind Vortex in the picture.
Ah, I'm so excited. But it's going to be so cool just to see how that whole magic, how magic is just going to be so much more visual, and you're going to feel it on the table more than just, I have a plus one save.
If the spell is active, if the endless spell is on the table and active, then in order to dispel it, you need to roll it. It's what you pick one of your wizards within 30 inches of it, and you just have to meet its casting value. You don't have to keep track of what the original cast of the spell was.
Oh, that's good. Otherwise, there'd be tokens everywhere. So good.
I think that's important to point out. Like, say for instance, they cast that endless spell and they get a 12 or something. You know, but the casting value is only 5 or 6. Then
right.
it might benefit you to let that one get out there and don't shoot for it. But then you could dispel it later.
Yeah, it's cool. I like it. I also like that. You can run it off the table to dispel it if you need to. So there's going to be a lot there. I mean, dude, that is going to change up so much. It's going to be very exciting to see. So I'm probably more excited about those spells than any other thing in the game.
They're really neat. I mean, I can't let it be undersaid that the box that they come in is incredibly satisfying. I mean, there's things in there for everyone, all the endless spells and the war scrolls. And it's going to be a part of the game. It's going to allow you to, I think, to do things maybe and add another layer of strategy to the game that is exactly what they want, which is this cool cinematic stuff.
Oh, yeah. And as a retailer, of course, I'm going to say everybody come buy it. But as a hobbyist and a modeler, you know, everybody out there is going to start like coming up with cool conversions. There's going to be there's going to be conversions out there and kit bashes and all these cool models that people are going to do, not just for their army, but for the spells now that their wizards are casting. If they have a themed army, you know, they may have like a dragon themed army. Well, all of a sudden their big flaming skull might be a flaming dragon skull or something. So it's going to be one more cool way to let people bring their imagination to the table. And I think I'm probably as excited about seeing people's ideas for what their spells should look like as I am about seeing what GW says these spells should look like.
Yeah, you may be right. So the summoning rules, we'll touch briefly on them, is that there are no more reinforcement points. Now, this has been covered in a Warhammer Community article, but I thought it's worth talking about. You know, you used to have just set aside points. Like, I'm going to set aside 500 points in my army for summoning. And now you don't have to do that anymore. Instead, you earn every... Or the armies that can bring things to the table have a way to, like, generate points or need a certain model to do something. You know, so, for instance, the Battletome Blades of Khorne, you don't set aside points anymore. You get blood tithe points. And then you're able to use those blood tithe points to summon in units based on a point cost chart. So, for instance, a Wrath of Khorne Bloodthirster cost 8 points, and a Bloodmaster Herald of Khorne cost 2 points.
This is going to be fun. I'm a little scared and excited.
Yeah.
Because Stormcast, as we all know, don't really summon a lot to the battlefield, which I still think is messed up because we teleport down on, like, lightning bolts, for crying out loud.
Everybody
just
gets there at the same time. That's how you ordered
so.
And unified
so.
Your army is.
But Seraphon, no, that's and Paul, I don't know if you know like the lore behind the Seraphon and like how the most of the army is basically just like memories. You know, they're the magical memory of the Seraphon that have like basically died out. So these slain are like casting.
It's a cool story, Ricky.
It's anyway, it's really cool. But the reason I'm talking about it is like it's a very thematic thing for Seraphon to basically, you know, summon more to the table and have these, you know, these memories of these lizard men like coming onto the table and fighting the battle. And so it's going to be really cool to actually encourage that, because before, you know, the Seraphon, most people just, you know, put them out there and maybe had one or two that they would try to summon and shoot them up the table. But now it's going to be one of their core mechanics, and one of their core tactics is going to change to really encourage seeing those models coming onto the table, you know, as the battle progresses, more and more models coming in and trying to, you know, win the battle. And I'm really excited to see that play out.
That's pretty cool. The Disciples of Tzeentch, this is just the next one here in the book, they can summon units based off of fate points. And you get a fate point each time a spell is cast, successfully cast. Not just you, it's you or your opponent casting spells.
Yeah, that's thematic, if nothing else, right?
Yes, so Tzeentch cares not from whence the magic flows. Kind of play on the corn thing there. Alariel.
That's why I had to laugh about it. We've got so many corn players in my area. I hear that like 5 times a day anytime somebody's playing. So it's just fun to see somebody, you know, poke a little fun at it.
So Alariel, the Everqueen from the Sylvaneth. Now, she hasn't been as active, I think, recently on the scene, you know, for several reasons. But now in her hero phase, she can heal D3 wounds allocated to each Sylvaneth model within 30 inches of this model.
Mm-hmm.
That's not too bad. And then once per battle in your hero phase, instead of using the ability to heal, you can summon one unit from the list below to the battlefield and add it to your army. It has to be placed. It gives the placement restrictions, but then it goes, the unit list is 20 dryads, 10 spite revenants, 10 tree revenants, 3 Kurnoth hunters, 1 branch witch, or 1 tree lord.
I can just bring a tree lord out?
Yeah.
Each turn?
Yeah, turn one, pop tree lord, then go to healing.
Oh my gosh. Well, guess who's back? Alariel is back on the table.
In your hero phase, you can heal D3 wounds allocated to each Sylvaneth model within 30 inches of this model, period. And then once per battle in your hero phase, instead of using its ability to heal, you can pick one unit from the units below.
Jeez. You know, and the thing is, though, like, you know, I hear Tree Lord, and then, you know, okay, yeah, obviously, let's go Tree Lord. But have you ever tried to kill 20 dryads standing in a Sylvaneth wildwood?
I was just going to say, I need you to put on my tab some terrain dice and 20 more dryads.
Oh, my gosh. My buddy put, I think it was like a 20 dryad blob in the woods and cast Mystic Shield on them a few weeks ago. I just quit attacking them. I just teleported my guys to the other side of the table and dealt with some other stuff over there. It wasn't worth it.
And
then to just get 20 freebies, that's great.
These summoning rules are in the General's Handbook. And I think this is our first episode. We are going to do more episodes of Sigmar in this edition. Absolutely. But, I wanted to bring you on, Ricky, and have us chat about this and give some initial thoughts. Man, I like it. I think it still kept that aggressiveness. I think you get to play with your characters maybe a little bit more than you did before. Then the characters get, with what they've done, like we just talked about Lariel and stuff, but, the characters are going to get more thematic with the wizards, with these endless spells and having summoning be a part of the game, be like a part of the game again, but still have to work for it. Like there's still ways your opponent can prevent you from getting a lot of these things to do. And then the rules just seem a little tighter to me. It's less, there's a little bit less wonky stuff. And I say wonky because, as a veteran, now the rules are not 40K rules. We compared them to things that we thought were familiar and similar. This feels like a pretty solid game all on its own.
Yeah. And that's, that was, so when Sigmar came out, great simplified rule set that was very approachable for newer players, and that was the one kind of thing that I thought about this new edition that I was a little concerned about, that the rules were getting a little more complex, was that my children, who are 8 and 5, would have a little bit harder time approaching that game, and newer players might be a little more concerned about that. But overall, I think that I can go to new players and say, yes, it is a few more pages. However, those pages are there to clarify and make the rules easier to understand, so it's less ambiguous. So
yeah, less interpretation you have to put
exactly
on someone to do.
Very excited. From everything we've talked about, I'm very excited. I cannot wait to see how everything changes and how people are going to build their armies in this new edition and this it's going to be like a whole new, it's going to be almost playing a new game. It's going to be very exciting. But and I think that's what I was going to say, was that I was a little concerned that, because 8th edition 40K basically piggybacked off of the rule set of Sigmar, but kept it 40K and tweaked things and made it work for 40K. So they're similar. You can tell they're brothers, but very different. And so I'm glad that Sigmar 2.0 didn't just kind of rehash what 40K did. They're still similar, but they're still very distinctly two separate games. And so I'm happy. I'm very happy.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for taking some time out of your night coming and chatting with me about this. And you guys listening to this Sigmar episode, expect some more Sigmar episodes coming soon.
We finally talked him into it, folks.
We'll see you.
Good night, buddy.
It's all in the reflexes.